The second book of Samuel, chapter 20. Remember, last week we were looking at the rebellion of Israel against David HaMelech. When that rebellion failed, they showed that they were sorry. They demonstrated that they were sorry for their grievous mistake. And they were the first to advocate bringing David HaMelech home. Well, David HaMelech sent off a message to his own people from the tribe of Judah. And he said, why are you the last ones to talk about bringing the king back? He didn't mean that they should jump ahead of the people of Israel, of the other 10 tribes. He said, you shouldn't be the last amongst them. Why aren't you with them? Why aren't you also lifting up your voice to bring me back from exile? The rebellion had been put down. His son Avshalom, who had led the rebellion, was dead. And the tribes of Israel were very practical and very sensible. They said, we've made a mistake. There's no use just sitting and crying over spilt milk. What we need to do is to show that we are sorry, to prove it. And they proved it by advocating the king should come back. Well, the men of the tribe of Judah just took over. Without consulting the other 10 tribes, they sent to the king, they said, we'll escort you back. And just lately, just as David HaMelech was crossing the river Jordan to come back to Jerusalem, half the people of Israel heard about it and they rushed down. They said, why did you let these, your tribesmen, jump ahead of us? We were the first ones to propose bringing you back. Well, there was a big fight. Whenever people are found in the wrong, they tend to get defiant and aggressive to cover up their fault. And that's what happened. There was a big fight. The words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. Now, at the height of this, when there was all this verbal fighting going on, a rebel stood up. The interesting thing is that when he tried to pull away all the 10 tribes after him to rebel against David HaMelech, not many followed him. And in that you have the proof that the people of Israel were sorry. If they had changed their tune again and gone after this rebel, then you could have said that it's like the book of Proverbs puts it, the dog returns to his vomit, so a fool returns to his folly. But we find Sheba, the son of Bichri, in chapter 20, didn't get a very large following. So the people of Israel, even under severe provocation, and even though they had been wronged by the people of Judah and shortchanged, they demonstrated that they were really sorry, that they really meant to stay loyal to King David. How are we going to check up on someone to know whether they have really changed their minds, if they've had a change of heart? Well, we can check them up under pressure. What do they do under pressure? In the Talmud, we have three tests of a man's true friendship. When he's drunk, when he's mad, and when you need money from him. In his cups, in his crossness, and in his cash. If when he's drunk, he's still your friend, and nothing you can do will make him renounce his friendship to you, that's a true friend. When he's mad at you, what comes out of his mouth? When you find that even when he's mad at you, he still talks to you like his friend, he's a real friend. And then when you need some financial help, this is a very touchy area, and he's ready to help you, he trusts you, that is a true friend. There's a story told about Alexander the Great, that young man who died at the same age as Yeshua, 33 years of age. He was very sick, and one of his best friends, who was a doctor, said, I'm bringing you something, some medicine that you can have that will cure you. Well, this physician, he was a doctor, he went and prepared this drink, this medicinal drink. But while he was preparing it, Alexander the Great got a letter saying, don't drink anything anybody gives you. It's all poisoned. Not long after he got that letter, his friend arrived with this medicinal drink. You know what Alexander the Great did? He drank it first, and then he showed his friend the letter, as though to say, I trust you with my life. I want to prove it to you. So here we have the people of Israel. Well, Alexander the Great didn't die, obviously. He went on to conquer other nations. Let's look at 2 Samuel 20. And there happened to be there a rebel whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, we have no part in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. So every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem remained loyal to their king. We have to try interpret that as meaning those that were there, those people of Israel that were there. Because we find that on the whole, they did not follow him. Verse 3. Now David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them in seclusion and supported them, but did not go into them. So they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. Then the king said to Amasa, assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days, and be present here yourself. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. David had to seclude those concubines because his son Absalom had committed incest with them. And so for the rest of their life, they were shut up, they were fed, they were looked after, but they had no children. We also find here the language of the son of Bichri, Sheba. We have no part in David. Well, the tribes had just been quarreling with Judah, and they said, we have 10 parts in David. This rebel says, we have no part. He doesn't even refer to him as the king. He calls him son of Jesse. It was a contemptuous way of speaking. That's the way Saul, the previous king, had spoken about David. He didn't call him David. He called him Ben Yishai, son of Jesse. Amasa was the one that David had decided to replace Joab. Amasa and Joab were cousins. They were both David's nephews. One thing you can say in favor of Joab was he was punctual. He was businesslike. Amasa was not so good. He was a little more woolly-headed. He was not organized. And so we find when 3 days had passed and this rebel was going through all the tribes saying, don't bother to follow David. Let's go back to our own tents. Let's form a separate kingdom or a separate entity. The time was flying. Time was of the essence. And at last, in verse 6, David said to Abishai, now Sheba the son of Bichri will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us. So David sent Abishai, the brother of Joab, to hunt down this rebel and the men that followed him. Joab went along as well, but he had been deposed. He was no longer David's general. David didn't have many soldiers. He just had his personal retinue there, the Cherethites, the Pelethites, verse 7, and the mighty men of Judah. So Joab's men, verse 7, with the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and all the mighty men, went out after him, and they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Finally, they caught up with Amasa. Here he was at Gibeon, which was in the territory of Benjamin. Verse 8. Joab went up to his cousin and pretended to greet him affectionately. Verse 9. Then Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in health, my brother? What would you do if your cousin came up to you and put his arm on your shoulder and asked if you were keeping well?" You wouldn't suspect anything, especially if he's a blood relative. And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But while Joab was going, his sword had fallen out and he picked it up with his left hand. Joab was left-handed. Amasa didn't notice it. Verse 10, but Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground. Thus he died. Here we see Joab the murderer. He didn't like being deposed. After all, he had a very important position as the general of David's army. It was humiliating to him, but he had killed Absalom. Absalom, even though David had given strict instructions, nobody was to kill him. Joab had killed Absalom. So Joab was a killer. He'd killed Abner, the son of Ner, who was the general of Saul's army. He killed Absalom, and now he killed Amasa. He seemed to be having it all his own way. There are times when wicked and violent people do have it their own way. But we find later on, justice did catch up with him. Well, they cornered Sheba. Amasa was left for dead. A soldier pulled him out of the highway, out of the road, so that people would not stop and stare at the gruesome sight. And they went off. Verse 14. Joab went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Maacha and all the Berites. So they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. Then they came and besieged him in Abel of Beth Maacha. And they cast a siege mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. So he didn't have many followers, because they all managed to crowd into one small city. Then a wise woman came to the rescue. After all, the people in that city were not all on the side of Sheba. And she could see there was going to be a kind of a bloodbath that was going to follow. So she used her wisdom. Verse 16. Then a wise woman cried out from the city, "Here, here, please say to Joab, come nearby that I may speak with you." When he had come near to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" The reason why she asked is because she was on one side of the wall, he was on the other. She dared not poke her head over the top, because there were always those people with archers, the snipers of the day, but they had bows and arrows in those days. He answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I'm listening." So they were shouting to each other through the wall. Then she spoke, saying, "They used to talk in former times, saying, they shall surely ask counsel at Abel, and so they would end disputes." She said, "This city has a reputation for solving problems. And now you want to destroy this very useful community?" She says in verse 19, "I am among the peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" So Joab told her what was the situation. He said, "A man from the mountains of Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bichri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. Just hand over the rebel, we'll call it quits." She said, "In effect, it's a deal." She said, "I'll get them to throw his head to you over the wall. Watch, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." So she went in her wisdom to all the people. At first, of course, they were defiant. No way are we going to give up this man. And she, as she reasoned with them and showed them that they were guilty of treason and that here were terms of amnesty, then they decided they would do it. So they beheaded Sheba, threw his head over the wall. Joab blew a trumpet and they withdrew from the city. That left Joab in charge of the army. He got back his old post by murder. And he remained general for the rest of David's reign. It was only under the reign of Solomon that justice caught up with Joab and he was executed. So we end this chapter with the story of Joab over all the army of Israel. Verse 23, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. They were expatriates. They were not Hebrews. They were people who followed David from other countries, mainly from the Philistines. They had become David's loyal soldiers. Adoram was in charge of revenue. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Sheba was scribe. Zadok and Abiathar were the priests. And Ira, the Yairite, was a chief minister under David. These names are important because they give us an idea of how we got these books of Samuel. We have Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Every day he would record the events. He would put them down. Then there was Sheba, who was the scribe, who would collate all this material. And then there was Zadok and Abiathar, who were the priests. And between them, they managed, under the guidance of God, to choose what was necessary to be included in the sacred scrolls, in the sacred books of Israel, so that they could trace the hand of God leading and guiding them. Regarding this wise woman, Solomon says in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 9, he speaks about the wisdom of this woman. And he puts it in a different way. He speaks about a wise man there. In Ecclesiastes 9, verse 13, he says, that's on page 581, "This wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and built great snares around it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that same poor man. Then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard." He also speaks about wisdom being better than weapons of war. The rebellion was put down. So David returned to his home in peace, but there was still a score to be settled. A score that reached back over 40 years, maybe 60 years. Isn't it interesting that God doesn't settle his accounts in a hurry? 60 years. We find with the case of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, it was a century and a half before he settled his score with Nineveh. Now here is the story in verse 21, chapter 21, famine. "Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, it is because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. The children of Israel had sworn protection to them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the children of Israel and Judah. Therefore David said to the Gibeonites, What shall I do for you? And with what shall I make atonement, that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? Remember the story, we read about it in the book of Joshua. These Gibeonites were amongst the people that our nation were told to wipe out when they came into the promised land. But the Gibeonites disguised themselves and pretended they came from a very distant country, and they made a treaty with the people of Israel. And it was only a few days later that the people of Israel found out they were just around the corner. They lived just around the corner. But the princes and the leaders and Joshua had given them their word. They had sworn to them. And to swear means to take, to use the name of God. And they said, very well, because you tricked us, we won't destroy you, but you're going to be our slaves. You have to draw water, you have to cut wood for the temple, for the altar, and for the sacrifices. And the Gibeonites agreed with it. All these years, hundreds of years, they'd been slaves to the people of Israel. They'd not rebelled. They had been obedient. They had been very loyal. In fact, we find even when they went to Babylon, they came back from Babylon after 70 years to continue being slaves to the children of Israel. That's how loyal they were. But Saul, the king of Israel, thought, these people, they tricked us. I know what we'll do. We'll wipe them out. It was a kind of genocide, like the Turks massacring the Armenians around the time of the First World War. The cruelty. I saw some photographs that an old friend of mine had. He was in the British Navy. And the British Navy had rescued some survivors. The hunted look in their eyes, the women, the children, the old people. Those poor Armenians slaughtered in their tens of thousands. And so it was now with Saul. He sought to wipe out the Gibeonites. He hadn't quite succeeded. And it looks from the way God spoke as though his sons, who were grown up, had helped him to do this. That's why God says in verse 1, it is because of Saul and his bloodthirsty house, because he killed the Gibeonites. We've seen how Joab was not immediately punished, and so we see here also that Saul's family was not immediately punished. Now, when we see something terribly wrong, be sure of this, that God is making a record of it. And sooner or later, the pigeons come to roost. Sooner or later, there's retribution. We don't get away with a thing. We find that when we do wrong to others, we get it back. We get paid back in our own coin. I guess we can all trace our own experiences, and we can all say, yes, I know this and this happened to me, and I know why it happened to me. Even God's children. God loves us too much to let us get away with it. So David said to the Gibeonites, what shall we do? We have to make restitution, otherwise the famine would continue. Well, the Gibeonites demanded the life of 7 of the sons of Saul. Verse 4, and the Gibeonites said to him, we will have no silver or gold from Saul or from his house, nor shall you kill any man in Israel for us. They said, verse 6, let 7 men of his descendants be delivered to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, whom the Lord chose. And the king said, I will give them. So he took 7 of those men that had been guilty and had been participating in the genocide, and he handed them over to the Gibeonites. But we read in verse 7, that the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of the Lord's oath that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. He took these men. Verse 8, Armoni and Mephibosheth, the two sons of Rispa, the daughter of Aya, and five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul. Now there's a problem. Michal, we read, had no children to the days of her death. The answer would be, of course, that she had brought them up like her own sons, because that's what the text says, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai the Meholathite. Who was this Adriel? When we go back to the first book of Samuel, we find that King Saul had promised his older daughter Merab to anybody who would kill Goliath. David killed Goliath. And so Saul had to keep his promise and give Merab to David. But then he got jealous of David and he gave Merab to a man called Adriel, the son of Barzillai the Meholathite. That was a tragic error on Saul's part. It's possible that Merab died and that Michal became their foster mother, and that's why she calls them her sons here. She brought them up for her widowed husband, for her sister's widowed husband. That would be the explanation. So these five sons also had been involved in the genocide against the Gibeonites, and they were executed together with the other two sons of the concubines. Verse 9, and he delivered them into the hands of the Gibeonites, and they hanged them on the hill before the Lord. See how magnanimous really the Gibeonites were. They could have asked for a lot more retribution, but they said that'll be sufficient. So they fell all seven together and were put to death in the days of harvest, in the first days, in the beginning of barley harvest. That would be around the time of Pesach. And then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of harvest until the late rains poured on them from heaven. She took them, she mourned for them, she guarded their corpses until rain fell. And the fact that now rain fell showed that the famine was over. That the famine was due to the fact that there was no rain, and also because of crop failure. But now, when the rain fell, everybody knew God's displeasure had been turned away. When David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, he took the bones of Saul, we're in verse 12, and the bones of Jonathan, his son, from the men of Jabesh Gilead. He brought up the bones of Saul and his sons and the ones that had been hanged. And we read in verse 14, they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, in the country of Benjamin in Zelah, in the tomb of Kish, his father. And after that, God heeded the prayer for the land. There we see how David did honor to Saul. Death ends all outstanding issues. And this is what happened here. Now they have paid with their lives. Saul paid with his life for inquiring of a woman that had a familiar spirit. These died because of their genocide, but now they have paid for their wrongdoing. Let us honor them. And so he buried them in their tomb. They were mercifully buried. The last part of this chapter deals with further battles with the Philistines. David Melech was by now getting on towards the end of his reign. His mind was still sharp, he was still active. But we often find as we get older, our bodies don't keep up with our demands. I remember when I came here, a friend of mine said, we go for a jog at lunchtime, the men of my office, would you like to join us? Sure, I've been doing cross-country running. I thought I'll join them. So I joined them. before I knew it, I was huffing and puffing, and for days afterwards my muscles were so stiff because I was out of shape. I'd forgotten it was years since I'd done running. And we forget our bodies are getting older. That's what happened to David as well. Here we are, verse 15. When the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David and his servants with him went down and fought against the Philistines, and David grew faint. Somehow his body would not rally. He didn't have the same stamina. Then Ishbi-Benob, who was one of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose bronze spear was 300 shekels, who was bearing a new sword, thought he could kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, You shall go out no more with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel. You're very valuable to us. So take courage, old men, old ladies. Take courage. Maybe you can't be so much benefit as you used to as far as energy is concerned and strength and muscle power. But you can be of help because of your wisdom, your maturity, your experience. You are very useful. In fact, you're more useful now because you're able to encourage those that are younger. One of the Psalms says that they shall be fat and flourishing. They shall still bring forth fruit in old age. And in the Torah it is commanded to rise up before the gray head and to honor the white hairs. So we see there is a reverence for age. There were other battles as well. Actually, there were four of them. And all of them were gigantic men. We read in verse 22, these four were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. These were probably the remnants of the Anakim, whom the people of Israel had been so afraid of when they sent their spies to look out the promised land. And we find also that God in his kindness sent Abishai, his nephew, to rescue David in his moment of weakness. God was faithful to David. He would not allow David to get killed in battle. One old writer said, David began his glory with the conquest of a giant, and here he concludes it with the conquest of four of them. There we are. The next chapter is David's song of praise. It's a long one. It goes right down to verse 51. God willing, we look at that next week. We're coming to the end of the book of Samuel. We find that towards the end of his life, he has really two songs to sing. One of them is in this 22nd chapter, where he speaks about the Lord being his rock, his fortress, his deliverer, the God of his strength, his shield, his stronghold, his refuge. He sings the praises of God in chapter 22. In chapter 23, he has another song. It is his swan song. He speaks about the ideal king. He's really speaking about our Messiah, the messianic king. He says, very frankly, in chapter 23, I must admit, my family doesn't measure up to this description, but there is one coming who will measure up to it. So it is a prophecy that he gives. Then follows a list of his mighty men and his last acts before he handed over the kingdom to his son Solomon.